Welcome to the End of Innocence. I'm your host, John Young. First, I want to extend my sincere apologies to our listeners and subscribers for the absence of last week's podcast. I had back surgery and, understandably, was a little preoccupied with recovery. I'd hoped to fill up the recording, but unfortunately, it just wasn't possible. The good news is the surgery went well, and I'm finally on the road to recovery. Now that we're back, we'll pick up right where we left off, continuing our discussion on the latest congressional testimony regarding the release of the JFK files. This week, we'll dive into the questions posed by the congressional panel to the witnesses who testified in last Tuesday's hearing. Then next week, we will cover part two of what we started a couple weeks ago, what Warren Report defenders and supporters must believe in order to claim Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone or even acted at all in the assassination of President John F. Kennedy.
Instead, the task force is meant to root out the hidden pockets of federal government that has for too long remained in the shadows of our reach, out of our reach for even good faith investigators to reach.
More than 62 years after the assassination of John F. Kennedy, we have now seen thousands of files released on the president's death. But tonight, some of those files are still unreleased. That and more were at the center of a congressional hearing this week, casting doubt on the federal government's findings back in the 60s, living witnesses to that dark day in American history, testifying that Lee Harvey Oswald could not have acted alone, and that it's unlikely a single bullet caused President Kennedy's death.
Based on what you witnessed, do you believe the CIA engaged in a concerted effort to cover up certain facts related to the assassination of President Kennedy?
Yes.
Are the wounds you observed consistent with the government's conclusion Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone?
No.
Testimony included allegations of tainted medical files, X-rays, lost bullet fragments, even parts of the president's brain gone missing. This hearing, the second on the JFK assassination from the House Task Force on the Declassification of Federal Secrets, was still untapped by that task force, headed up by Representative Ana Paulina Luna. Unidentified aerial phenomenon, UAPs. We've yet to hear a public hearing surrounding the UFO mysteries in our skies. Why is that? Could that soon change? For more, we are joined by News Nation special correspondent Ross Coulthard, investigative reporter and host of the Reality Check podcast. Ross, it's always good to see you. Thanks for making the time.
It's a pleasure, Natasha.
Ross, was this not one of the main reasons behind the creation of this new task force? Why hasn't a public UAP hearing happened yet?
Frankly, I don't know. I mean, some of the allegations that have been raised, particularly this week, are extraordinary. I mean, you had, for example, a doctor who was treating JFK, the President of the United States, at Parkland Hospital within minutes of his being shot. Direct, first-hand evidence of the wounds to the president's body. And that doctor, Dr. Don Curtis, who was one of the physicians at the Parkway Hospital, he basically, Parkland Hospital, he testified that he saw wounds that definitely came from the front of the president, i.e. not from the Texas Book Depository where Lee Harvey Oswald was allegedly located. And this is one of two physicians at Parkland Hospital who's testified to this in the past. It was quite extraordinary to hear his evidence. But frankly, Natasha, you won't see that evidence reported anywhere else except for News Nation. It's been largely ignored by much of the mainstream media, and I find that bewildering.
Yeah, why do you think that
the
is?
The implications are enormous.
Yeah, tell me why.
I think there's a resistance. I don't think there's somebody pulling the strings behind the scenes. I just think that the media is locked into a cycle of denial, that it's such an incomprehensible thing to contemplate the possibility that a president was killed in a coup d'etat in 1963. And that's what we're talking about. More importantly, as you referred, there's still obstruction from the CIA to the release of certain files. And when the Hunt Committee on Assassinations in the 1970s was investigating the assassination, and it did find there was a conspiracy, one of the people who was involved in supposedly helping was a guy called George Ioannidis. And he was a covert liaison officer with the CIA. And it's been discovered by people who were working on that committee at the time, and this was the evidence of a guy called Dan Hardway, who was a former HSCA, House Select Committee for Assassinations investigator. He says that Ioannidis was basically obstructing their attempt to get access to file, particularly the evidence that the CIA had on Oswald's alleged involvement in a meeting with the Russians in the Soviet embassy in Mexico City. So you have to ask, if there's nothing to hide, why is the CIA still allegedly obstructing ongoing attempts to get to the truth of the JFK case?
Still questions.
Thank you. I'd like to now recognize the gentleman from Arizona, Mr. Biggs, for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I thank the witnesses on the panel for being here today. So I have questions, I think, for most of you, and I need a quick response if I can, but for me first, I will ask ultimately of all of you the question, why? Why did this move the way it did? So, Dr. Curtis, you observed back of President Kennedy's head, he saw an exit wound. And you said that didn't align with the theory that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone in shooting President Kennedy. Is that fair to say? Oh, I'm sorry. I'll speak up. I'll try to be louder. You indicated that you had no doubt that the wound that you observed to the back of President Kennedy's head was an exit gunshot wound. Is that fair?
Yes.
And you concluded, after review, that it did not align, his wound did not align with the theory that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone in shooting President Kennedy. Is that true?
Yes.
And I guess you struggle to this day to understand the Warren Commission's theory about the president shooter and how it seems to have discord with what you actually observed that day. Is that fair to say?
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Hardway, so you have indicated that you essentially were subject of a covert operation as you served on the House Select Committee on Assassinations. Is that fair to say?
The CIA called it a covert assignment.
And that was from, Mr. Ioannidis?
Ioannidis.
Yeah. Ioannidis. And you've called on the release of Mr. Ioannidis' file to the public. Is that fair to say?
It's fair.
And so I would actually echo that call to the chair that we see if we can get Mr. Ioannidis' file released. And I'd like to continue on this. I only have 2.5 minutes, but I have to get to the ultimate question. Why? Why did the CIA intervene with Mr. Hardway's review? Why were documents altered? Why was the Zapruder film removed and not brought back in its original documented form? Why? And so I'm going to ask you, if you can answer that, you would probably solve what Ms. Koh referred to as trust. There is a massive amount of skepticism about our federal government, and I think you can directly trace it back to this event. So I want to know why, and I think that's what all of America wants to know. We can kind of get a feeling of what happened, but we all want to know why it happened the way it did. Why was there this mastering, this control of all of this operation? So I'm going to start with you, Mr. Horn. And then go down to each one of you. And then I have a list of documents that I think need to be released, Madam Chair. Mr. Horn.
There is so much medical evidence that is tainted or missing or destroyed.
But why did that happen?
Or altered. There's no reason to have confidence in the autopsy. Those things I'm going to get there, sir.
Okay.
Those things would not have happened if Alon Knight had killed the president. If Alon Knight killed the president, there's no reason to do all those things. To destroy x-rays, to possibly alter autopsy photos, although that's not yet been determined. It's a question that remains outstanding. To alter the existing skull x-rays. So you don't do those things. And you don't change the autopsy conclusions four different times within 2 weeks after the president's death if Alon Knight killed the president. So it's clear to me that the government, these are my conclusions after years of study, it's clear to me that the government was trying to manage what story it could sell to the American people. That's what was going on. And that's why the autopsy conclusions changed four times in the first 2 weeks. Have I come close to answering your question or not?
Yeah, Mr. Horn, you have. I don't have time to ask and get a response from all of you. And so we'll just go down to Judge Thunheim.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question you pose as to why. I mean, I think that clearly, if you look at the history of all of this, there were a cover-up by both the FBI and the CIA, perhaps other organizations, in part because they had a lot of contact with Oswald in advance of the assassination. And there's no evidence that they alerted the Secret Service to the erratic behavior of Oswald. Oswald was in New Orleans. There was CIA contact with him then when he was a volunteer for this Fair Play for Cuba committee. I mean, they knew all about his visit to Mexico City. Both the FBI and the CIA knew about it. The FBI was following him in Dallas because he was a suspect in another shooting. All of this suggests that they had a lot of contact with him ahead of time. And the I don't know what that suggests other than the fact that they wanted to cover that up, the fact that they knew a lot about him ahead of time and didn't do much about it.
Thank you. And Mr. Hardway, do you subscribe to that as part of the explanation, as well as the not a lone gunman, lone gunman nut theory of Mr. Horn?
I have no opinion on Mr. Horn because I don't know anything about the medical evidence.
Okay.
In regard to why the CIA would go to the length of running an operation against us, they obviously had something that they were very desperate about hiding. And I go into that in my written statement.
To do it,
you have to get into the weeds of the details. Basically, just to summarize it, they were using Oswald operationally in Mexico City.
Thank you. And since I'm going to be out of time, let me just go real quick. I ask that we obtain a copy of Mr. Hardway's report. At least I don't have it regarding Oswald in Mexico. Release the Joint 80th file, the JFK files in Belarus and Moscow, files on Jack Ruby, Manchester interview, Jacqueline Kennedy and Robert Kennedy, and also, Madam Chair, finally.
Thank you, Mr. Basil.
Bruder film.
We'll be taking a look at that, and then also referencing the Joanides files so everyone's tracking. We are actively trying to track that down. I believe that that is the one outstanding document that the CIA will not be able to find, so isn't that interesting?
Judge Thunheim, I just also want to ask you, just similar to what I asked Ms. Koh, do you think that this release of the records that just happened has added any substantial new information to what we already know?
You know, I think any release of records gives you more color, more pieces of the puzzle, so to speak. And I think this has been very interesting. I haven't had a chance to look through a lot of the materials, but a lot of the materials that have redactions in were materials we never saw. So they weren't shown to us before. So I think that is significant that there are documents being released there. I don't see any answers, any new answers to any of the old questions here, but it's filling out the record more. And I'd like to see a time when everything has been released, unredacted. It's 60-some years since the assassination. It's the assassination was closer to World War I than we are to the assassination. Let's release the materials. And that's my plea here, is just get everything out, let people decide what they want.
Thanking Rep. Garcia, the chair would now like to recognize Mr. Burchett. 5 minutes.
Thanks, Chair Lady. Dr. Curtis, what happened when the more information called you to testify about what you knew about the JFK one?
Well, the Warren Commission hasn't called me to testify at all.
Not at all? Okay. Can you explain what condition, when President Kennedy arrived in the emergency room, what was his condition at that point?
He had already died.
Okay. How many wounds did you observe on President Kennedy?
I mean, wounds. President Kennedy had a wound to, of course, the big wound to his head.
Right.
He also had a wound to his throat. And I've got a little diagram here. I can point that out, how that worked, if you'd like me to.
And that wouldn't have been a single bullet wound, though, right? They talk about this magical bullet that traveled. That would have been more than one bullet, you think?
Magic bullet was not, didn't strike the president at all.
Okay. Yeah, that was a clean bullet. I saw the. Yeah. Oh, well, yeah. Please show the diagram.
Okay. The bullets that were fired, blue bullet is the was the bullet that arrived first. And you can see it started from probably from the railroad trestle, which is to the southwest, and came up and first took President Kennedy before he got out from under the tree that prevented the window shooter from shooting. Then, and we know that because of the Zapruder film showed President Kennedy to holding his throat in real distress when the Zapruder film started. And he had already been shot, and that wound to his throat would have killed him. It did kill him, because we know from the tracheostomy that we had to do that the bullet to his throat obstructed the trachea, and so he had taken his last breath before that. Also, the bullet that struck President Kennedy in the temple killed him also, because he just removed a third of his brain. The two bullets that came from the Connally, from the window, one struck Connally, and it's the only thing that it did. Went in Connally's shoulder, went through his chest, came out of his chest, into his left wrist, into his left leg. And that indicates that the bullet was coming from the north, going southeast, southwest, and that bullet was only for Governor Connally.
And that was, how many bullets did you say? Three or four?
That were fired?
Yes, sir.
Four.
Okay, and that was a bolt action Italian carbine.
Two of the bullets came from the front.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I know, but they were trying to tell us Lee Harvey Oswald was the
only bullets that came from the window were two bullets, and three bullets came from the window. One hit the curb, the other hit Connally, and the other one went in the president's back. And that's well documented.
Yes, sir. Thank you. And I yield no time.
Thank you. The chair would like to now recognize Mr. Burleson for 5 minutes.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Hardway. It's clear that you faced firsthand the obstruction by the CIA. Would that be accurate to say in your investigations?
Yes.
And specifically, they used methods like use of sealed envelopes, redacted file redactions that violated the 1977 Memorandum of Understanding. My question really is about what seems to be evident is that they were very much obstructing any information about Oswald's interactions in Mexico City.
That's correct.
Why do you think that is?
I believe that we can draw reasonable inferences from the evidence that is of record, and that is very persuasive and clearly of record, that are facts and not theories, that clearly point to the fact that Lee Harvey Oswald was being used in an operation in Mexico City in September of 1963, in early October of 1963. The nature of the operation was a dangle in a propaganda operation designed to discredit Fair Play for Cuba Committee. It was designed and ran by George Joannides under the supervision of David Allen, Natalie Phillips, who had been leading the CIA's anti-FPCC efforts since 1958. And it was a very successful operation. The Cuban consulate had just recently opened. The operation allowed them to observe from a distance the interactions and reactions of the, not just the Cuban consulate, but the Soviet embassy, Oswald's presenting himself. And it also went a real long way to discrediting the FPCC. In addition to that, you can see the exact same pattern of operation was conducted using Oswald in New Orleans in August of 1963, in which he encountered the DRE, also encountered student groups. It's almost the exact, it's a shadow of what they then did in Mexico City. Now, the fact that, in my opinion, the fact that they ran Oswald operationally in Mexico City does not mean necessarily, or even inferentially, that they were involved in the actual assassination. It's entirely possible that on November 22nd, two of the most surprised men in the world were David Atlee Phillips and George Ioannidis. And consequently, the one doesn't necessarily lead to the other in any way, shape, or form. But stop and think about it. If they were running an operation in which the accused shooter was involved as an asset, either witting or unwitting, think about the motivation for cover-up. It had to be something extraordinary that they were covering up in order to violate their charter, and in spite of the Houston Agreement that agrees not to prosecute CIA officers for crimes committed in the furtherance of their duties in the United States, in spite of that, they feloniously obstructed a congressional investigation. There had to be something significant that they were covering up, and what that significance was. And basically, David Robarge, the CIA historian, has in a backhanded way admitted that in things he's written, was the use of Oswald in an operation in Mexico City.
So you think that it was, if you had to be pressed on it, it sounds like there's two scenarios. One is that Oswald, I mean, both scenarios, Oswald was had some involvement and a connection with the CIA. But in one scenario, he's being directed by individuals in the CIA to commit the assassination. And then the other scenario is that he did it and they just flubbed. They didn't pick up on the fact that he was planning this assassination.
I don't think we can draw any inference from the evidence on any of that as to whether or not he was being directed in the assassination. I don't think that David Phillips and George Ioannidis were directing him in the assassination. I don't think they would have been in Mexico if they did.
Some of the documentation indicates recently that from the 2017 release that he was not alone when he went to Mexico City.
I can't say that he wasn't alone from the research we did in Mexico City. What we couldn't rule out was that he was imitated, or that another person was there pretending to be Oswald, or that some of the telephone conversations that were recorded on the tap were actually Oswald speaking. In fact, it's pretty clear that some of the calls that claimed to be Oswald were not Oswald.
Wow. Thank you. My time has expired.
Thank you. The chair would like to now recognize Mr. Crane for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Ms. Chairwoman. Thank you guys for coming today. I want to start with you, Dr. Curtis. As a dental surgeon who was present in the hospital room the day President Kennedy was shot, you were able to observe his wounds and maybe some of his medical records. Is that correct?
Yes.
How old were you, sir?
How old was I?
Yeah.
26.
26. And what did you observe when they brought the president in?
The president was already in the room before I arrived. And what I observed about him, that he had probably already deceased.
Since you were a dental surgeon, why did they bring you into the operation room?
That's one thing Arlen Specter asked me. What he is a dentist who been operating on the president. And I had to qualify myself. The training that I have would encompass those particular procedures. And that's a simple procedure, and I did it well, and I just knew how to do it. There was nobody else there to do it, and I did it because Dr. Perico asked me to do it.
Can you tell us about the wound that you observed on the president and how they differ from what came out in some of the reporting?
The wounds on the president were to his throat and to his head and to his back. The wound to his throat would have killed him. The wound to his head definitely would have killed him. The wound to his back would not have killed him.
Did the wound to his throat and his head look like completely separate wounds?
There were two separate wounds. Let me show it to you. The blue wound was sent from the railroad trestle all the way over to kill him right here, and that went to his throat. And the way that killed him is that it inflicted the trachea, and he couldn't breathe. So he would have been dead before he reached the hospital simply because of that wound. The other wound that he had to his head killed him instantly because it removed about a third of his brain.
Thank you. Mr. Hardway, I want to move to you next. You talked about the obstruction of a federal investigation that you yourself witnessed. You were on the House Select Committee for Assassination, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
What year would that have been?
1977, 1978. The obstruction occurred early in 1978.
What was your role in that investigation?
My role was a researcher with primary responsibility for researching Lee Harvey Oswald's activities in Mexico City and the CIA response to that.
We've heard about some of the administrative roadblocks that the CIA put up for you. Did you have any direct verbal communication with anybody at the CIA?
Oh, yeah, frequently.
Can you tell us about some of those conversations and how it might have been conceived as obstruction?
Well, when we first started, we had unlimited, unexpurgated access. We had two clerks assigned to us. We had our office at the CIA. Pretty much went to work out there every morning. We'd ask for a file. They would go get it. We would review it. It was unredacted and given to us in original state. After they brought George Ioannidis in, he began slowly tightening down the process. We were no longer working with two clerks who went and got us our files. We had to file formally requests through him to get the files, and we started experiencing significant delays in the files that we would get. We started noticing that the files we would get would have obvious things missing from them. Then he went so far as to actually start putting parts of the files in envelopes and leaving them in the files. So what we would get is we would sign that we'd seen the files, but we weren't allowed to open the stuff that he had placed in envelopes. That came back to haunt us later in dealing with the final report and some of the things we were trying to get out of them, when they would tell the chairman of the committee, he'd seen that, here's where he signed for the file. And I would have to explain to Chairman Stokes that no, that was not in the file when I saw it, because that was what I was looking for and it was not there. It must have been in one of the envelopes. And so he eventually just shut us down. It culminated on one file that I really wanted to see. When it was presented to me, Mr. Ioannidis showed up himself to give it to me. He was actually bouncing on his toes. Him and Scott Breckenridge brought the file to me at the CIA, called me back out there to see it. It had not just been redacted, it had been retyped with the redactions in white space as it had been retyped. It was a report on a debriefing of a certain person. I exploded. I acted like a very angry 24-year-old and had choice words for both of them, and stormed out of the office and went back to the headquarters. I subsequently, thanks to Judge Tenheim's work, saw the memorandum to the record that Dr. Breckenridge wrote. And the memorandum for the record says that the file was shown to me and, quote, no objections were recorded, close quote. Notice the way, you have to watch what the CIA says. He didn't say that I didn't make any, which is what everyone infers from what he said. What he said was none were recorded, and that's because he made the record.
Thank you. I yield back.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your leadership on this committee. For decades, elements in our government have engaged in an extensive cover-up to subvert the will of Congress and to keep the American public in the dark relating to the assassination of John F. Kennedy. No matter how ugly it is or how inconvenient it is to elites, organized crime, or deep state bureaucrats, the American people deserve the truth, and they can handle the truth. While the American public still may be in the dark, poll after poll make clear the cover-up has failed. Approximately two-thirds of Americans still don't buy the official narrative from our government that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. Cover-ups and a failure to be transparent has rightfully bred distrust. So much distrust, nearly 40% of Americans believe the United States government was involved in the assassination of JFK. Let that sink in. Nearly 40%. This task force, working alongside President Trump, is working to use sunshine as a disinfectant and give the American people the pure, unvarnished truth they deserve. Mr. Hardway, thank you for being here to all of our witnesses today. You worked for the House Select Committee on Assassinations, which investigated the assassination of JFK. You had firsthand interactions with the CIA as you worked to get the truth. Based on what you witnessed, do you believe the CIA engaged in a concerted effort to cover up certain facts related to the assassination of President Kennedy?
Yes.
Do you believe the efforts to obstruct congressional investigations into the assassination of President Kennedy by the CIA you've described violated federal law?
People more expert in federal criminal law than I am have expressed that opinion to me and have expressed that opinion under oath.
Based on what you know, what relationship, if any, did the CIA have with Lee Harvey Oswald prior to the assassination of President Kennedy?
Based upon the circumstantial evidence of record, and it is overwhelming, they had they used him as either a witting or an unwitting agent.
Seems that way, doesn't it? Do you believe there was evidence to suggest the CIA was using Lee Harvey Oswald in active intelligence operations shortly before the assassination of President Kennedy?
Yes.
Dr. Curtis, yes. Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon.
You were one of the physicians who treated President Kennedy at Parkland Memorial Hospital after he was shot. You were better situated than almost anyone to see President Kennedy's physical condition when he arrived at the hospital. And yet you've said, I can't reconcile my knowledge of what I saw with the findings of the government, is what you said at the time. Yeah. In your medical opinion, what do you attribute as the cause of President Kennedy's wounds?
The cause of his death?
Mm-hmm.
The two bullets were fired from the front caused his death.
Mm-hmm.
And either one of them would have.
And in your medical, in your opinion, how does this differ from the findings of the government as to the cause of the wounds to the president? How did this differ?
Could you say that again? I'm sorry.
How were your findings that you saw of his condition when he died, how are your findings different from the government? How did what the government said happened to John F. Kennedy Jr., John F. JFK? How did your medical findings of his death, how were they different?
The government wanted the president to have died from the window, from the bullets fall from the window, because that would have called the Harvey Oswald to have done it. And they went to great lengths to make those two bullets do the job. And those two bullets did not do the job. One went in President's back. The other went into Governor Connally. Those two bullets didn't do anything to kill President Kennedy.
Okay, my last question, Dr. Curtis, you ready? Are the wounds you observed consistent with the government's conclusion Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone?
No.
Thank you, sir. We thank all of our witnesses who are here today. Chairwoman, thank you, and I yield back.
Thank you, Representative Mace. I now recognize myself for probably more than 5 minutes. My first question goes to Judge Tenheim. Why did you tell President Biden that the CIA had deliberately misled your board about the Joe Needy's file?
I did that because the CIA misled us. I mean, we had asked, we're picking up names all along, and people were telling us about other people to ask about. And we've been after the Joe Needy's file for a while, and what we got was something very small. It looked like just a personnel file, when he got paid and, when he separated and that sort of thing. And the staff looked at it and thought it wasn't significant and sent it back. In retrospect, we shouldn't have done that. We should have asked for more. But they were told that the staff was told that was all they had on Joe Needy's, which is clearly incorrect. That's why I said that we've been deliberately misled by the CIA as to the nature of the Joannides files that were there. And I think the files likely are still there and can be released and should be released.
Yeah, I'd like to actually know for the public that's tuning in that we have been in talks with Director Radcliffe, and although he's been supportive, there has, in my opinion, been an orchestrated effort previously to hide this information. And so they're, while actively searching for it, also having issues locating it. So we are trying on our end, but you are correct, sir, in that observation. And I thank you for being here today to testify to that. Now, my next question is actually for Dr. Curtis. Was there anyone specifically on the Warren Commission that made the attempted effort, or that you felt you were being pressured to either be silenced on what you saw and or bullied and or threatened into not speaking the truth?
I was never pressured to be silent, but I did have action with Arlen Specter.
What happened, sir?
He did a deposition for me. Had not told me about it ahead of time. The nurse leaned in the operating room that morning and said, "The Warren Commission is in town. If you have time, go down and talk to them." So I finished my cases and went down and talked to our inspector. He was friendly and nice and very well groomed in a beautiful suit, shiny shoes. And I had my hair all messed up in a scrub suit, dirty shoes. So it was definitely top down. And he was friendly and nice and then started asking me biographical questions and made it obvious to me that he knew the answers to the question before he asked him. And so that made me wonder, why on earth does he know that all that about me? Then he said, "What did you see about the exit wound?" "Well, there wasn't one." "Really?" "No, there wasn't one." And then, so he asked me four more times about the exit wound. And the last time he asked me is, "Dr. Curtis, every other doctor has suggested and testified that there was an exit wound. You didn't see it?" "No, I didn't." And so during this, he said that I had with him was maybe about 20 or 30 minutes. And during that time, he made me feel that I had the reason for being in the trauma room to be sure the president died. Now, I had a wife and two babies at home that were completely dependent on me. If I lost my residency, it would be a big problem for me. So he said, "Okay, now, I should wait here for a little bit before we do the deposition." He said, "Deposition?" He said, "Yes, you're having a deposition during the day." And I said, "Well, I didn't know that." He said, "Well, I sent you a letter," which I didn't get. He said, "You want a lawyer?" So, "Do I need a lawyer?" He said, "Fella, you're the only one in this room that knows if you need a lawyer. Do you want me to get you one?" I said, "I don't think so." But he asked me over and over again about the exit wound. Then we got in on the committee, got the committee together. Then nobody that I'd ever seen before sitting behind a table and put me on a high stool uncomfortably. And I remember my foot kept slipping off that bottle rung. And then started asking me questions. Never did bring up the exit one. Never did say a thing about it. Well, at the last, he said, "Dr. Curtis, did you see anything that was like a puncture or a little thing in the trachea or the throat?" I said, "No." And he said, "But then I thought, well, the blood was right over that, so I couldn't have seen it." So I said, "That didn't mean it wasn't there. Thank you for Dr. Curtis." It's what he wanted.
Would it be fair to say that other doctors that you worked with that were in the room that day that were responding to President Kennedy's wounds had the same observations as you? Yes or no?
There were two of us that thawed the throat before the tracheostomy was done.
Okay.
And is that the answer?
Whatever you would like to share with Congress, sir.
So I saw it, and there was no exit wounds. That's what Law Inspector wanted, was an exit wound, because the magic bullet had to exit the throat over fondly, which couldn't have happened. The magic bullet would have had to make 390-degree turns to do what it did. It was coming down from the window, would have had to turn right angle, just be horizontal from the neck, would have had to turn right, and then over to wherever the colony was, would have to turn right again, go in the throat of her colony. It doesn't work.
Yes, sir, I can speak for myself. I do not believe in the magic bullet theory.
I do not, sir.
My next question is for Mr. Douglas Horn. To your knowledge, did even the Dallas Police Department or the FBI subject Lee Harvey Oswald to a paraffin test to determine whether he had fired the gun on November 22nd, 1963?
I'm going from memory, but I believe the FBI did, and he tested negative for firing a rifle.
The
paraffin test on his face shows he did not fire a bolt-action rifle, especially not a lousy rifle like the Mannlicher Carcano, which was 1894 design or something.
What is the status of the record interview the author William Manchester conducted with Jacqueline Kennedy? Mr. Horn?
My understanding is that, first of all, the Kennedy family liked William Manchester initially because he had written a campaign book in 1960 about the campaign. So they said, okay, why don't you write the book about the death of Jack, the death of President Kennedy? When the book was reviewed by Jacqueline and Robert F. Kennedy, apparently Robert F. Kennedy had many objections. And so the Kennedy family sued Mr. Manchester when the books were in galley form. And they've required that he take out certain portions of the text. So what the lawsuit did was it said, portions of the text that you removed will be sequestered until 2067, and the interviews you did with Jacqueline Kennedy and Robert F. Kennedy will be sequestered, withheld until 2067. So that was the result of that lawsuit. So what we read today when we read Manchester's book is a sanitized or redacted version of his book, and we won't know what was removed until 2067. That's just very unfortunate. And I know Chairman Thunheim really made an effort to get Caroline Kennedy to agree to lift that court seal, and she didn't want to.
Also, to your knowledge, which autopsy photos are missing?
Okay, I'd be glad to answer that question. I have a list here, and it's reasonably succinct, so bear with me.
Well, you have me and Garcia here, so yes. I think...
Okay, here we go.
We're at your disposal.
There we go. I mentioned 8 sets that I know with confidence from studying the evidence as an analyst are missing. First, an overhead wide shot of JFK's body taken from a stepladder, taken by John Springer, the Navy photographer. He testified under oath to that. Second, a large bruise atop the right lung, taken from inside the interior of the chest after the lungs were removed. So this is a large blood clot up above where the apical portion of the lung was. And that's been testified to by both Dr. Humes and Springer that they took those photographs, so they're not in the record. Third, an entrance wound in the lower right of the skull with the scalp reflected, taken from outside the skull. And next, that same entrance wound in the lower right of the skull with the photo taken from inside the cranium after the brain was removed. So what's at issue with these two photos being missing is they would have determined definitively where was the entrance wound in the back of the head.
Well, that would have been one of the Harper separate?
No, separate issue.
Okay.
The condition of the back of the head, here's another missing photo. The condition of the back of the head after embalming and reconstruction was completed, which still showed an exit defect that could not be closed. The witness that claims that was Sandra Spencer, a Navy photographer's mate who our general counsel, Jeremy Gunn, considered our most reliable medical witness. And so what she did was she developed color negatives and then prints of the president's body, postmortem photographs. But she said, when we deposed her, she said, Oh, these pictures in the archives are horrible. We see open body cavities and a lot of blood, and the president looks really bad. She said, the photographs that I developed, he had been cleaned up. The head had been reconstructed, but there was still a hole in the back of his head even after the head was reconstructed.
So you have witness testimony that the archives photos do not reflect what...
Yes, okay. Yes, she testified under oath to that fact. Another missing photograph is a series, is that Robert Knudsen was a White House social photographer. He was involved with developing photography the weekend after the assassination by the president's military physician, Dr. Berkeley. So Knudsen testified to the HSCA that I developed a black and white film pack, negatives, black and white negatives, showing numerous probes in the president's body. And of course, probes are important because they determine bullet tracks. Where do bullets go in? Where do they come out? If they come out. And he remembered developing them and holding them up to the light in the dark room after they were developed. And he remembered seeing probes in the body in this black and white film pack. And in the official autopsy collection, there was no black and white film pack used in photographs of the body. They're 4x5-inch duplex film. They're not black and white film packs. And there are no photographs of probes in the body in the official collection. And one of the people we interviewed was Dr. Carney, who was a resident at Bethesda. And when we told him, Jeremy Penn and I, when we told him that there were no photographs of probes in the body in the official autopsy photo collection, he became visibly agitated and his face turned bright pink. And he said, I came in and out of the morgue many times as the resident on duty that night, but I saw flashbulbs going off when there were probes in the body. And you're telling me there's no photos in the collection. We said, that's right. So two more that are missing, and that concludes my answer. Black and white prints were seen by numerous people showing a large exit defect in the rear of JFK's head. So Mr. Knudsen, the White House photographer, Navy Chief Knudsen, showed such photos to another White House photographer, Joe O'Donnell, the week after the president died. Black and white prints showing a big exit wound in the back of the head. Well, there are no such photos in the collection, but Joe O'Donnell said there were, and another witness that saw those photos was Navy Corpsman Dennis David, and he was shown those photographs by the Bethesda Naval Hospital audiovisual department head, Lieutenant Commander Pitzer. The last type of photo that's missing, black and white prints of an entry wound high in the forehead, up here, not in the temple, but high in the forehead, above the right eye. Black and white prints showing that were shown by Mr. Knudsen, by Chief Knudsen, to Mr. O'Donnell. They were also seen by Dennis David when Lieutenant Commander Pitzer showed him autopsy photographs. And there a third witness surfaced in the year 2010, Quentin Schwinn, who lives in Cleveland. And he, during a federal job interview, believe it or not, during a federal job interview with an intelligence agency, when he was at the Rochester Institute of Technology, majoring in photography, he was shown a color-positive transparency showing an entry wound high in the forehead of JFK. So that's my kind of lengthy answer on which photographs am I confident are missing.
Thank you very much. And then real quickly, because my last question, line of questioning is for Mr. Bolden, what is the evidence that you refer to about an interruption of chain of custody of President Kennedy's body prior to the start of the autopsy shortly after 8 p.m.?
Right. Yeah, because of this venue and this format, I'll have to give you a streamlined answer. I'm sure everyone will appreciate that. We know for a fact that the motorcade from Andrews Air Force Base with a bronze Dallas casket in it, arrived in front of Bethesda at 6:55 p.m. Remember that time. That's documented by the Secret Service report of Agent Clint Hill and by newspaper reporters. But the review board obtained an extremely important document written by a Marine Corps non-commissioned officer, Sergeant Boysen of the United States Marine Corps. He led a team of Marines from the Marine Barracks in Washington, D.C., to provide physical security at the autopsy. This was not the honor guard in dressed uniforms. These were Marines from the Marine Barracks to provide physical security. He wrote a report of what happened that night, and he wrote in his report, dated November 26, 1963, he wrote that And he's only talking about what happened with the president because that was his job, was to guard the president's body during the autopsy. He wrote that the casket arrived at 18:35 hours. 18:35 hours. That's 6:35 p.m., 20 minutes before the motorcade from Andrews arrived. And there is a considerable amount of evidence, a wide range of evidence, that the president's body really arrived by helicopters before the motorcade from Andrews. That's the broken chain of custody. And the issue here, it's a very important was, is a very important issue. The issue here is, if Sergeant Boysen's report is correct, and he authenticated that to the review board staff, he authenticated that to me with a written letter and with a telephone interview. If his report is correct, then what was happening with the president's body between 6:35 p.m. and 8 o'clock when the autopsy record started? That's almost an hour and a half. And the simple answer, the streamlined answer, appears to be that many metal fragments were removed from President Kennedy's body before the autopsy record began. We have witnesses for this.
Those would be the bullet fragments, correct?
Yes. Tom Robinson of Gawler's Funeral Home saw a vial full of 10 tiny fragments, which he saw picked out of President Kennedy's brain. They were never placed in the record. Dennis David, HM1 foreman Dennis David, typed a receipt for a federal agent of 4 large bullet fragments. He thought it would be mass larger than 1 bullet and less mass than 2 bullets, somewhere between 1 and 2 bullets, 4 large fragments. He typed the receipt. He was allowed to handle the fragments by the federal agent. We wouldn't do that today. And the agent took the receipt, typewriter ribbon, and the fragments, and they were never introduced in the record. So we also have 2 witnesses. To make a long story short, we have 2 witnesses to surgery on the cranium to get this evidence out. And Dr. Humes, the chief pathologist, said under oath to the Warren Commission to Arlen Specter, I correct myself, Dr. Hume said under oath that I never had to perform a craniotomy. I never had to saw the skull open to get the brain out. And when Dr. Fink arrived late for the autopsy, he was the outsider, the Army guy, he arrived at 8:30. Humes told Dr. Fink, no sawing of the skull was necessary. So the end of my response here is that we have 2 witnesses, X-ray technician Ed Reed, under oath to the review board, and Tom Robinson, to both the House committee and to the review board. Tom Robinson told the same account to both the HSCA and to us that he saw, Dr. Humes saw the skull open. So I think bullet fragments were removed from the president's body before the autopsy of record began, and that's why we should have no confidence whatsoever in the autopsy.
But I would like to thank all of you. We've gone way over our time today, but the fact that you all traveled in and were willing to come testify, especially you, Dr. Curtis, Mr. Bolden, Judge Tenheim, Mr. Hardway, Mr. Horn, and Ms. Koh, thank you so much for coming here today. If you do have any other information you would like to submit to the task force, we will happily accept that, and we will be following up on some of these suggestions that you have all made today. With that, without objection, all members will have 5 legislative days in which to submit materials and additional written questions for the witnesses, which will be forwarded to the witnesses for their responses as well. If you'd like to submit anything else to the record, we'd be happily accepting of that. If there are no further business, without objection, the task force stands adjourned.
If you like what you hear every week and want to learn more about the assassination, please pick up my book, The End of Innocence, The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's available right now on Amazon, or you can find it at www.endofinnocencejfk.com. In honor of the release of the JFK assassination records, I'm sending out signed copies of my book. If you would like one of these, please email me at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. The price is $40 for the soft cover and $60 for the hardcover, plus shipping and handling. I can promise you, you won't be disappointed in the book. It's an oversized coffee table style book. The book is over 500 pages with almost 1,000 pictures. you won't be disappointed. And hey, send me your comments about the book or this podcast at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. We'll see you next week.